PFT Media.
This is the Experience with Chris Fio. In each episode, Fio brings his unique and unashamed interview style to Central Florida. He conducts honest and open interviews with people that have the vocabulary and expertise that he lacks.
In this episode, Chris speaks with respected broadcast journalist Eric Sandoval, and they talk about reporting the news around the country and his experiences covering the Paul shooting.
Gun in a holster, that vision is slipping like a worn transmission. The days of transporting and not transmitting, cause the transcontinental flow.
Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Experience with Chris Fio. Today I have with me Eric Sandoval of WKMG Channel News 6. And I want to start off by saying, Mr. Sandoval, it is an honor to have you on an episode of The Experience today.
Don't call me Mr. Sandoval, that's no. My dad. Call me Eric.
All right,
thank you. It's great. To be here with you.
Oh, nice, thank you. So take me through a day in the life of Eric Sandoval.
Oh, man. You know what? I'm a creature of habit.
Yes.
So I work nights. I primarily do the 11 o'clock news on News 6. So that means I get home really late. I get home, you know, midnight, 12:30, and I usually go right to bed. I'm exhausted at the end of the day, you know. But where most of my colleagues actually sleep till like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the morning, I'm up at like, you know, 8:30, because I like to get things done.
Go get it. You got to hustle.
Absolutely. I don't like things piling up. I like to just get it out of the way. So I get up, have my coffee. I go either running or lift weights or go to yoga and get back and start really focusing on what I'm going to do for the day. You know, I watch our news. You know, I read news online, see what's going on. You know, get acclimated with what's going on and try to generate some story ideas, you know.
Nice. And
then I go into work and we have our editorial meeting and then it's off to the races.
Nice. And you are a man of very many traits. When I did a little research on you, and you are very, very good at online strategy from what I have read upon you.
Thank you. Like, yeah, little bit of history on me. I, you know, most of my experience is in TV, but for about 3 or 4 years, I got out of the on-air side, and I was actually the digital content director for a group of television stations, ABC, CBS, Fox, and Telemundo in Southern California.
Wow.
So, you know, I was, you know, feet first into the, digital strategy, social media strategy, you know, news online. So I sort of got savvy with that.
Yeah. How was it like when you first had to, you know, attack something like that?
This was when Facebook and Twitter were just starting. You know, this was in the late 2000s. So, you know,
2009.
Yeah. So, I think everybody was, it was a work in progress as far as, you know, getting a strategy, campaigns. Everybody was trying to figure out what this was all about. How do we use this to, you know, get people to watch our news? Is it going to replace news? And actually, you know, 10 years later now, we're still asking that question. Is it going to replace TV news? Because a lot of times it is. I mean, think of how many times you look at your phone on it.
A bunch of times a day.
Exactly. Yeah. You're getting news constantly. It's not just, you know, the 24-hour TV news channels. It's Facebook. It's Twitter. It's Instagram. And it's hopefully clickorlando.com. But it's a constant moving beast. And so we're all having to adapt to that. And it's changing every day, and it can get a little overwhelming, but it's also fun at the same time, you know, trying to figure it all out.
Right. What are some of the strategies you've come up with to really renovate or innovate, you know, online marketing or news sourcing?
I think part of, you know, my personal strategy is, and, you know, I think a lot of my colleagues at News 6 is, the thing that's missing from, you know, a post you'll see on Facebook from CNN, from, you know, a television station, you know, people like to look at a friend and say, oh, he's telling me to look at that. And so I think more and more we're trying to actually, you know, project ourselves more on social media instead of just saying, hey, here's a news story. You know, this just in, breaking news. You know, I post pictures of me going running. I post pictures of me, you know, just doing my Saturday, Sunday, and Monday through Friday. And my Facebook followers are more of my Facebook friends on my News 6 page because we interact, we talk. Hey, how's the family? Oh, did you try this? I went to the movies today, and people were chiming in on, hey, did you like the movie? You know, and I think that builds a trust, and it builds loyalty. And I think then when we post, hey, this is a breaking news story and you need to look at it, they'll be more likely to look at it.
Wow.
So I think, you know, we know social media is good at posting content immediately, but it's looking at who it's coming from and building the trust on where it's coming from.
Wow. I could see why whenever I was studying on you, you boosted fan base by 150%.
Yeah.
With your strategy.
Yeah. It's
that's incredible.
You can't see this, but I'm brushing the dust off my shoulders. Thank you.
He does need that the dust brushed off his shoulders. That's a very impressive feat. And you've come up with a couple strategies. What are some of the bigger strategies you've had other than the one you've just explained?
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it's all trial and error. And we're all trying to figure this beast out as we go along.
Right.
But at the same time, we don't want to... You know, whether you're a television station, whether you're a news website, whether you're a podcast, whether you're, you want people to come to you, and you don't want them to go to Facebook, and you don't want them to go to Twitter. You want them to come to you. So it's just figuring out how to get them off the social media platforms and coming to you directly.
So you have to market on the media. You have to market on there.
Yeah.
Just yeah.
Sort of like a billboard.
Yeah.
It's like a billboard, but with a little more heart, you know, a little more connectivity, a little more, you know, hey, how are you? You know, back and forth instead of just the, hey, watch us. Hey, read us. It's
right.
Hey, I'm here to talk. Let's talk.
Yeah, exactly. And the media, I think, from what I've seen, has been changing towards more of that, like the Joe Rogan's bringing you a story from, you know, just from his name, mm-hmm. with all the many different people he's had on his podcast, mm-hmm. and a lot of the big stories that people get would be from his podcast just because it's Joe Rogan. And I think you implementing what you're doing is actually the new wave. Mr. Eric Sandoval, the character, you know, is something that I believe that you are putting in the forefront very well.
Well, thank you.
How is it like to have first gotten yourself into the field of digital marketing or news media? How did you break in?
I think every life experience prepares you for the next life experience. And when I was a kid, I was a shy, fat kid. And we had just moved to California. And I was, you know, shy and coming out of my shell. So my mom threw me into children's theater. And so I was on stage singing, dancing. I was a munchkin in The Wizard of Oz. I was one of the playing cards in Alice in Wonderland. And it just, it built from there. I was in theater in high school. And I became comfortable with myself in just talking, you know.
Were you looking to be an actor one day?
At one time I was, you know. I took vocal lessons. I took dance. Triple threat there.
Oh, Dick Van Dyke there.
Yes,
wow.
I was. But then my senior year of high school, they had a journalism class. And it was a newspaper at the time, the school newspaper. And, you know, I was always raised, my mom was, you know, yelling at me, turn the news on. I wanted to watch Lost in Space, but she wanted the news on. So we'd always turn the news on. And, you know, the news anchors when I was a kid became friends of the family. You know, we didn't know them, but they were in our house.
Yeah.
And you knew them. You know, when I was a kid, I was in San Francisco, and it was Dave McElhattan and Wendy DeCuda on Channel 5. And that's who we welcomed into our house every night. And
oh,
so, you know, I took the journalism class, and I liked writing. I liked reporting. And so, you know, I had a discussion with my school counselor, and he goes, well, you know, if you're into theater and journalism, why don't you just try broadcast news? And so I majored in that and got an internship at a TV station, and I think the rest was history. I got an internship at a TV station my senior year of high school, and I learned how to edit video when I was 18 years old.
Oh, wow.
And that was a few years ago. But it was off to the races after that. I graduated the University of North Texas.
How many years did you go to North Texas?
I went there for 3 years. I hopscotched. I went to Southern Methodist University, then San Francisco State University, and then University of North Texas.
Why was that? Was it because you moved a lot?
It was financial. It was mostly financial. Just SMU was cool. I got a scholarship and then went back home to be with mom and dad, then went back to Texas. But I ended up graduating there, worked in news radio in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for a few years, and then got my first TV job in Waco, Texas. Right after the Branch Davidian raid.
How was that experience? Was it everything you expected, or was it different?
Well, this was before the Magnolia Home HGTV, Waco, Texas.
Okay.
It wasn't as savvy back then.
You get away with a little bit.
Exactly. It was an interesting experience. I was there for about 4 years, and I was a TV news anchor for the CBS affiliate there. And, you know, it sounds all glamorous, but it didn't. No offense to the TV station I worked for them, but it did not pay anything. So I tried to get another job, got one in Illinois, and then that started the hopscotch across the country.
Right. Did you learn your investigative strategies from there, or when did that come in?
I learned a lot of my investigative strategies in Waco. I had the best news director in the world. His name was Rick Bradfield. And, I don't know if you know about the Branch Davidian siege and standoff in Waco, Texas.
Don't.
That may have been before your time.
Yes, it was. What year was that?
Yeah, it was 93.
I was way young. I was probably 4 years old.
Okay,
yeah.
I was out of college. But it was a huge story. It was a national story. It was a religious sect that was in the middle of Texas, right outside Waco, Texas. The ATF and the FBI launched a huge raid on this on February 28th, 1993. And that started a 51-day standoff between David Koresh, the prophet of the Branch Davidians, and the federal agents. For 51 days, there were guns drawn at the compound. They were hanging signs out saying, go away. It was just an amazing time. But our station was eventually sued by the FBI and ATF for spoiling the element of surprise.
Oh, wow.
So our news director at the time learned everything there was to know about that standoff, about who the ATF agents were, the FBI agents were, who David Koresh was, who the Branch Davidians were. He knew everything. He had file cabinets full of documents. They were floppy disks back then, but floppy disks full of information. And I watched and I learned. You know, use databases, use spreadsheets, keep tabs on the news that you're covering, the people that you're covering. And to this day, whenever I cover a crime story, I have a spreadsheet and I list the person's name, their case number in the court system, a link on clickorlando.com of the story that we covered them, and I follow up with them every week to see where they are in the court system, what's going on, and it's proven pretty well. So
wow.
That was just one of the places I learned, but the other one, honestly, has been my colleagues at Channel 6.
Yes.
We have a very talented investigative unit, and whenever I have a question, I go over and go, hey, guys, I don't know how to do this. Do you? And they go, yep, let me show you. So we help each other. It's not in our newsroom, it's not a competition with each other. We don't beat down each other. We help each other and lift each other up.
Right. So, I was going to ask, that was going to be actually my follow-up question, was the environment usually, was it competitive or helpful, but you've already answered that.
Well, and I have to say, in our newsroom, people ask me, I've been there 7 years now, and they say, well, don't you want to go somewhere else? And, any other station that I have worked for in my career, I would have gone, yes, I really do. I'm working on it.
Not right now.
But this station, I've never worked for a station with such an environment of family before. You walk into work, they expect you to do your best. They expect you to bring your A game. But at the same time, if something's going on, sit down and let's talk about it, whether it's work or not. If you're having a problem at home, let's talk about it. You get it out in the open, and they'll put their hand on your back and, pat you and hug you and it's a good environment.
Was that an immediate feeling, or was there like a stage where they had to warm to you?
I want to say it's current management. Let me put it that way. They provide a wonderful culture to work in. And I think they have reaped the benefits of that from every person who works there. People enjoy going to work, and so do I. And I don't think you can say that very often.
No, you can. A lot of people very rarely can say that.
Yeah.
And that makes for a good investigative journalist. And you're also a fill-in anchor as well. How does that work out? Like,
well, I'm just a pinch hitter. We know if somebody's going on vacation, they go, "Hey, Eric, can you fill in?" Sure. But I mean, I do have to say, this is my first reporting job in my career. My previous jobs have been anchoring. So, you know, if I have to sit in the anchor chair, I know what I'm doing.
Okay. So how's the difference with reporting versus anchoring?
It's a totally different kind of thing. You know, reporting, you have to build your contacts. You have to not be afraid to go to scenes where there might be an active shooter. You know, there's a shooting that happens on, you know, we're on Mills. Let's say there's a shooting on Mills Avenue.
Yeah.
You know, Eric, go with your photographer. So we go. And, you know, many times we arrive at the scene and the police are saying, "Hey, stay back there. We don't know where the gunman is." You know, and you just go, "Okay."
Wow. That's scary.
We put ourselves in danger. And we don't, I don't think we realize it at the time because there's so much adrenaline going, yeah. But you know, when you get home, you go, "Oh my God, I could have died tonight."
Like, I'm crazy. Holy moly.
And what do? I get up and do the same thing again tomorrow.
Wow. What was the most dangerous situation you've been in?
Pulse.
Yes.
Pulse. Dangerous, witnessing the danger.
Yeah.
You know, I was not inside Pulse, but I was one of the first reporters on the scene.
How was the feeling of that day? Take me through that.
A couple of years ago, I wouldn't have been able to do this without crying.
Okay.
But I usually don't work weekends. But that Saturday, Donald Trump was in Tampa campaigning at the time because he hadn't been elected. So I was assigned to go to Tampa to cover Trump campaigning. That was a full day on Saturday. I came back here I was living here, and partied at the pool with my neighbors and got my story done. And then 2:30 in the morning, my boss calls me and she's mad. Allison, if you're listening, sorry. But she was mad because nobody else had answered their phone. She said, "You're the last person I wanted to call because you worked yesterday, but I have another shooting, and I need you to go." I said, "Okay." You know, I put on my jeans, I put on my shirt, and I said, "Where are we going?" She said, "Pulse." And I knew of Pulse. I knew where Pulse was. So I get in my car, drive down Orange Avenue, and I'm on the phone with my assignment desk, and they say, you know, Orlando police are going to hold a press briefing at the 7-Eleven at Gore and Orange. And I pull up, and we're there. Channel 6 is there, 9, 2, 35, all of us are there. And we're all looking at each other going, "Where are they?" And so I tweet to Orlando police, "Where are you? We are all waiting at the 7-Eleven." And they respond, "Press briefing's been canceled. Information to come on Twitter." So we all go down, and as far as they would let us go, I don't know if you're familiar with that section of SoDo, but the farthest they would let us go is right past the emergency room at ORMC, Orlando Regional Medical Center.
I know where that's at.
There was a barricade there. They would not allow you any farther. But coming away from Pulse, there were people just, you know, crying, hugging. They were, you know, obviously traumatized by what they saw, and we're live on the air, and we're wall to wall, not knowing anything, relying on Twitter from Orlando Police for the latest, and listening to the scanners, hearing what's going on. We heard a concussion explosion, the boom, boom, and usually that's used by negotiators to dull the senses of somebody who's, you know, either in a hostage situation or barricaded or, you know, held up somewhere. And it was about 15, 20 minutes after that you heard the of of law enforcement making entry into the Pulse nightclub. And it was moments after that that the barricades came down and pickup trucks started coming towards us with, I can only say, you know, blood-covered bodies in the flatbed of the truck going to the emergency room. And that image is something that's going to stay with me for the rest of my life. You know, now I know it was them making entry, the sound of the gunfire. And it's that kind of situation where you go home, and that day I was on the clock from 2:30 a.m. to roughly 4 p.m. And I walked into our newsroom and I looked at my boss, Allison McGinley, and she said, "You all right?" And I just broke down. And everybody in our newsroom had the exact same experience when they walked back in. It touched us. And I know it touched this entire community, but it rocked us.
It left a scar on Orlando.
Absolutely. But just to smell it, to see it, to hold, you know, Christine Linenen, who lost her son. I met her on the steps of Orlando Regional Medical Center that morning, just to experience what they were experiencing. It made you feel human, but not in a way you wanted to. So that was the toughest assignment that I've had to date.
Oh my goodness, I really feel for you and the pain. It impacted a lot of people. I knew a couple friends who worked there, mm-hmm. and it impacted me as well. And I was calling them all that night. I was with my ex at her house, mm-hmm. and she woke me up saying something's going on. Like, because she was on Snapchat, and there was all these like Snapchats going on about Pulse and the shooting going on. Mm-hmm. And she did not know what was happening. And I'm like, my friend works there. So I'm calling her. And she was busy because she wasn't working that night. She was busy taking calls from her friends that worked mm-hmm. there that night. So it touched a lot of us.
That said, like, as you said before, what came out of it, the horror that we saw on June 12th, 2016, if there is a silver lining, it was the love that really came out of Orlando. And I still think it's here. You know, it's not as prominent, not as, you know.
But there is the connection that it.
Absolutely.
That it codified.
I think it connected people who weren't connected before. It made a lot of people more respectful of people's struggles. It made people more respectful and loving to each other just on a daily basis. I think it made us a city of love, but it made us a city of more understanding and compassion, you know?
And that's what I've noticed in the community as well. People's attitudes after that date have been, they don't want to see you go. Like almost someone mm-hmm. who's just like, I don't want this to be the last time I look at you.
Mm-hmm.
Like you get that feeling from others. Yeah.
And no matter what the festival is, whether it's Pride, whether it's a walk, you know, an AIDS walk or the Alzheimer's walk, or whether it's you know, a pet walk at Lake Eola, there is a feeling of love, and you just feel that whoever you look at, when you're passing by, it's almost a trust. It's like we all live here, we all love each other. Let's have a good time.
I like that because we have a new generation of people growing up, and it's better that the world becomes more connected this way because mm-hmm. we all need to understand each other. We all need to break away from our own bad habits and vices and presuppositions mm-hmm. we have about one another. So it really could help, you know, especially with youth. You know, we have people like Greta Thunberg, you know, going into the forefront to help the world.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's
and we had students here that walked out of school.
Really?
Oh yeah. I mean, it was. She has a powerful voice.
She absolutely does. And I learned this about you from Patty Sheehan because I was trying to get more information about you, and she told me you're a father as well.
I am.
Yes.
Patty telling fibs on nose. Yes, I have twins.
Really?
Yes, they're. I'm old.
oh no, you're not.
They turn 22.
22
years old now. I adopted them when they were three.
Wow.
Names are Robbie and Alan.
Oh.
I lived in Illinois at the time. They were born in Southside Chicago. And, yeah, I love them to death. They keep me young, but they make me feel old at the same time. Does that make sense?
It does, actually. You know, I do the same thing to my dad.
I think we all did.
Yes, we do. Was it your choice, or what were they brought to you out of?
No. It was me and my ex-partner. We decided to adopt, and we decided to adopt one child. And our social worker called us and said that another social worker had called her saying that she was leaving her agency that she was at, but it was her last mission to find these twins a home. And I'd be interested in at least going up to Chicago to meet them. So we went up to Chicago, and we ended up falling in love with them. First sight, just sweet as could be. I mean, little monsters at the same. They were three.
Yes, they were. They're going to be.
They were
monsters.
Three, and they were, you know, running all around the house, and you know, they were being 3-year-olds. I look back. I look at them now, and I look back and think that I had a role in teaching them ABC, teaching them how to read, teaching them math, teaching them how to talk. Because they could barely talk when we adopted them, because they
really?
Were foster kids. Nobody had really nurtured them and spoke to them. I never really sat back and thought about that until now. But I guess it's interesting to see what an impact parents have on kids.
That is amazing.
Especially those two. Robbie and Alan are very special people. They're very special men. They're very talented. They're athletic as heck.
What are they doing? Like, are they athletes, or what field are they in?
So they both started doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Wow.
And, yeah. And my son Robbie still is really good at it. I mean, he's still on the mat, loving it.
Has he gone competitive?
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah. Wow. Yeah, he's won awards. He's in it. My son Alan sort of drifted away from it a little bit, but he went to the more physical training, lifting weights, and you do not want to mess with him. He is giant. He is a giant. What was he lifting in the... I forgot what he was lifting in the front yard. I think it was just big bags of sand. It was big bags of sand. And he's just picking them up and throwing them, and then picking them up and throwing them again. It's like, Mike, you go ahead and do that. I'm going to yoga. I'll see you later.
That is amazing.
Yeah, they're good kids. Really good
kids.
I'll be
the same way. I'm like, I'm just going to go on a bike ride.
Uh-huh.
You do that.
Or I'll just sit here and watch you.
Yeah, this is entertaining. Wow. How long can you go, son?
Yeah. So, great kids.
Oh, wow.
Great kids. They have a great future ahead of them.
Yes, they absolutely do, and they're already off to a great start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, how has that changed you fundamentally as a person, or did it change you?
Oh, it's changed me in so many ways. It's made me more understanding, more patient with people in my life. You know, when you're teaching a child to read, or teaching a child anything, when you're scolding a child, when you're just talking to a child, it takes a lot of patience. And just, hey, okay, calm down, you know. And I find myself channeling that a lot, whether it's in the field when I'm trying to interview somebody, you know, calming them down, interviewing a child, or even just dealing with my coworkers sometimes. I think we all can act childish.
We've
you know
all,
what I mean?
Yes, we all been there.
But it's made me more patient with people. It's also made me more aware of where people may be coming from. I don't know where they're coming from. I don't know what's going on in their past. So I just need to treat them with respect, because my sons came from Southside Chicago. It was not a good situation. But you know, to meet them today, you wouldn't know that. So, you know, it just made me more cognizant that everybody has a past that they're dealing with, some luggage that they may be dealing with, and to be respectful of that.
That's amazing to hear, and, you know, that's really awesome. And when I asked Anwar about how he was impacted as a father who he lives in, he used to live here. Mm-hmm. You know, he's one of the brothers of Most Deaf, and he has his own amazing things in his own right. But he was telling me something like that when he became a father, that he's focusing more of his life to being a great father. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's really that I see more with parents, and I'm beginning to hear that.
And you also find yourself trying to be a good example to them, showing them what they can be. And, you know, I honestly don't know what I'd be doing right now if I wasn't a father, because I think half of my drive is to set a good example for my kids, you know, and at the time to provide for them. You know, I'm not providing for them so much anymore, but I strive to be a good example and try to show them that anything is possible if you put your mind to it and your drive to it.
You're a wonderful person. You know, you are a wonderful father.
Well, thank you.
You are.
I try to. I try to show them. I don't know if I succeed all the time, but I try.
You put the effort in, and, you know, it's clear to see with who you are and how you speak about yourself and your children and even your coworkers, too. It's amazing to see that. And we're coming to the top of the hour on the experience, and I have one final question, and this is the Fio question.
Uh-oh.
So, knowing that how media is going with the news, that you must become a character, you must become everybody's neighbor, you must become part of the family, mm-hmm. What sets you apart from every other news source or anchor out there right now? Why should we pay attention to Eric Sandoval and let him into our home?
Because I'm staying here. Orlando's my home, and it's not a character to say that I am your neighbor, because I am your neighbor. I live in the same community you do. I go to the same restaurants you do. I come to the same art galleries and, you know, Brass Tap across the way. This is my home, and I'm concerned about what is happening in our backyard. And if something is concerning you about where we live, I want to know about it. I want to investigate it, and at risk of sounding like a cheese ball, I want to help get results about it. That's our moniker at News 6, getting results. Orlando's my home. I've been here 7 years, you know, and I'll admit, my previous stays at TV stations have been 2 and 3 years, 4 years tops. I like Orlando. I love Orlando, let me put it that way. And I love where I work. And as long as they'll have me, I plan to stay here and keep doing the darndest I can.
Well, Eric, I think you have sold us, all of Orlando, to you, and we all love you and want to keep you around.
Aw, thanks.
All right, thank you for being on another episode of The Experience.
Aw, thanks, Eric, for having me. Thank you.
Have a good night, everyone.
Go, but right now I know there's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. There's no place that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. Just you and me. There's no place that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. Just you and me. There's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. There's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. There's no place that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me.
The Experience with Chris Fio is produced by Boris Douglas Garbe and Kai Legal. It is a joint production of Borma, Vonti, and PFT Media. The theme song is You and Me by NWAR Superstar.
A PFT Media production.